Welcome to the Kingdom Reformation Podcast with Glenn Blakeney. Here the fire of revival ignites hearts and fuels a supernatural move of God throughout the nations of the earth. Join us each week for prophetic insights, apostolic teaching, and powerful conversations that will equip you to live fully awakened in your kingdom purpose. This is more than a podcast. It's a movement. Learn more about us by visiting kingdomreformation.org. Now, let's dive into today's episode.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a step back, way back into 16th century France. It's a time often painted with the shimmering colors of the Renaissance, you know, an age of art, learning.
Absolutely. A real flourishing of culture.
But beneath that surface, it was also, starkly, an age of blood. Hard to picture, really. A time when counterfeiting might mean being boiled alive.
Yeah.
And punishments for heresy were, well, even worse.
It's this world of incredible contrasts we're diving into today. We're looking at the really turbulent origins of the French Reformation and the story of the people who became known as the Huguenots.
And we've really dug into the sources for this one. Historical texts, yes, but also a deep look at Professor Baird's work.
Right. And what's fantastic about Baird's research is that he used newly explored European archives, unedited memoirs, contemporary letters, things that give you a much more, let's say, unguarded view than just the official histories.
Exactly. It feels like getting behind the scenes.
Yeah.
So our mission today, we want to figure out how these Reformation ideas actually took root in France. What forces helped them grow against all odds?
And the incredible challenges people face just for believing differently. We'll uncover some surprising things about the kings, the church, and just ordinary people swept up in it all.
Okay, so let's set the scene. France in the early 1500s. What did it look like?
Well, geographically, it was starting to look a lot like the France we know today. Power was becoming more centralized, moving away from that older feudal system.
And culturally.
You start seeing Paris becoming more dominant, Parisian language, Parisian manners. There was this push towards a more unified national identity.
And ruling over this evolving France,
yeah.
King Francis I, from 1515 to 1547. He has this reputation, doesn't he? The great Renaissance king.
He absolutely does. A huge patron of arts and learning. He brought scholars, artists, thinkers to his court. He founded the College Royal, the Triling, focused on Greek, Hebrew, Latin. He really valued excellence.
There's always a but, isn't there?
There really is. Because alongside this cultural patronage, his reign was incredibly harsh. The sources talk about barbarous punishment for crime and, crucially, not less for heresy.
That example you mentioned earlier, the merchant boiled alive for counterfeiting in 1527.
It's chilling.
It really brings it home. It shows that behind the Renaissance glitter, there was this iron fist. Order was maintained, often brutally.
So it's into this world, this mix of high culture and extreme punishment, that the first real seeds of the Reformation start to sprout in France. What was the first major clash?
And pretty quickly, actually, with something called the Concordat. This was an agreement between Pope Leo X and Francis I.
Yeah.
And it essentially gave the king and the pope a lot more control over the French church, the Gallican church, sidelining some of its traditional independence.
And that didn't go down well.
Not at all. Huge pushback from two very powerful groups.
Yeah.
The Parliament of Paris, the main judicial body, they stalled on registering it for ages, and the University of Paris, particularly its theological faculty, the Sorbonne. Didn't the university rector actually ban printers from printing it?
He did. Used his power of censorship.
Yeah.
It shows how strong the resistance was. It wasn't just about the agreement itself, though.
What else was feeding into it?
Well, you have to look at the state of the clergy at the time. There was widespread, well, let's call it moral laxity. A contemporary writer, Brantôme, gives some pretty vivid descriptions.
Ooh.
He talks about monks electing abbots and priors based on who was the most fun, the biggest drinker, the most dissipated. He even says they'd get into physical fights, fist and sword, during these elections.
Wow. More like a bar brawl than choosing a spiritual leader.
Exactly. So this kind of corruption made the established church look bad, and it created an opening, you know, fertile ground for people questioning things and looking for alternatives.
Which brings us to the Meaux group. Who were they?
These were some of the very early reformers in France. Figures like Gérard Roussel, Jacques Lefebvre d'Etaples, they started preaching these new ideas.
And who was listening? Was it just intellectuals?
That's what's really interesting. Their message really resonated with ordinary working people. The sources mention wool carders, weavers, and fullers specifically.
So it wasn't just top down.
Not at all. Right from the start, it had this popular grassroots element, which makes the story of Jean Leclerc even more potent.
Ah, yes, the wool carder from Meaux. What did he do?
In 1524, he did something incredibly bold. He saw a papal bull, an official decree from the Pope, posted on the cathedral door. He tore it down.
Just tore it down.
Yep. And replaced it with his own placard calling the Pope the veritable Antichrist.
That took some nerve. What happened then?
The reaction was swift and brutal. He was subjected to a barbarous sentence, burned alive, slowly. It was a horrific public example of the cost of defiance.
A clear message from the authorities.
Absolutely. Don't challenge us directly. But even with that kind of brutality, the reformers weren't entirely alone, were they?
No. And this is one of the surprising twists. Francis the Sir's own sister, Margaret of Navarre, was a key protector.
She really was. She sheltered reformers like Lefebvre, tried constantly to moderate her brother, to show him the fanaticism of some of his advisors. She was pushing for reform, maybe even from within the church initially.
Her influence, even if limited, must have been crucial.
Definitely. But opposing voices were powerful too, especially the Sorbonne.
Right, the theological faculty of the University of Paris. They held huge sway, didn't they?
Immense authority, not just in France, but across Europe. They condemned Luther's ideas very early on, back in 1521. But the sources suggest that, despite their history, they'd become incredibly resistant to change. Scholastic bigotry is the phrase used.
So they saw these new ideas as a fundamental threat.
Yes. It seems it was partly intellectual rigidity, a defense of their own authority, but also, you know, a genuine fear. A fear that changing religious doctrine would unravel the whole social fabric.
And this rigidity, this fear, it leads to a major flashpoint, right? The Placards Affair in 1534.
A huge turning point. Anonymous posters attacking the Catholic Mass, the papacy. They appeared all over Paris and other cities.
And crucially, one even ended up on the king's bedroom door.
Exactly. That made it personal. It wasn't just dissent anymore. It felt like a direct, almost intimate challenge to the king himself.
How did Francis react?
Publicly and dramatically. He led this huge procession through Paris, barefoot, very pious, to atone for the sacrilege. He made a very public declaration that he would live and die Catholic.
So it hardened his stance significantly.
It did. And people at court, like Cardinal Tournon, used it. They hammered home the idea. See, religious change equals revolution. It equals chaos. It confirmed the king's fears.
But Francis was still a politician. Despite this strong Catholic stance, he was making alliances with Protestant princes in Germany, even with Henry VIII in England. How does that work?
It comes down to his motto, apparently. Ami jusqu'à l'autel, friend up to the altar. Meaning, yeah. Politics is politics, religion is religion. He'd make alliances for the good of France, even with heretics, but it wouldn't change his personal faith or his policies within France. National interests could override religious consistency in foreign affairs.
A pragmatic, if perhaps cynical, approach.
Very much so. But this period under Francis ends on a truly grim note. The Vaudois massacres in 1545.
Tell us about the Vaudois. They weren't exactly the same as the new Protestants, were they?
No, they were an older group, pre-Reformation, living mainly in the southeast in the Durance Valley, known for being industrious, quiet living, but they were seen as heretical.
And what happened in 1545?
An official decree, the Arrêt de Mirandol, had already condemned them. In 1545, a military campaign was launched. It was just butchery. Villages burned, people massacred indiscriminately, men, women, children, even the unborn. Utterly horrific.
A brutal end to his reign. Which brings us to his son, Henry II, reigning from 1547. His reign is often called the Reign of Fire.
It really was. And what's fascinating, or perhaps disturbing, is that Henry himself is often described as naturally quite gentle, even humane.
So how do you square that with the intense persecution under his rule?
Well, the sources suggest a couple of things. One theory is that he felt he had to be harsh on heresy to sort of atone for his own rather dissolute private life.
A kind of religious compensation.
Perhaps. But maybe more importantly, his courtiers saw massive opportunities. Confiscating the property of condemned heretics was incredibly profitable. Persecution paid, literally.
So greed played a major role alongside any religious conviction.
A huge role. And one of Henry's first moves was to set up a special court within the Parliament of Paris just for heresy trials. It became known as La Chambre Ardente,
The burning chamber?
Exactly. Named for the sheer number of people it condemned to be burned at the stake. It was an institutionalization of the terror, really.
And they tried to clamp down on information, too, right? Banning books from Geneva, from Germany.
Strict prohibitions. Anything Protestant needed Sorbonne approval, which wasn't likely to happen. But here's the paradox.
It didn't work.
It absolutely didn't stop the spread. If anything, the Reformed doctrines seemed to spread faster. New underground churches popped up. Existing ones grew.
Which shows the limits of suppression, I suppose.
It really does. And critically, during Henry II's reign, we see more and more high-ranking nobles getting involved. People like Antoine of Navarre, the Prince of Condé, François d'Andelot.
What were they doing?
They started openly supporting the Protestants, attending secret meetings, using their influence, sometimes even physically rescuing preachers who'd been arrested.
That must have changed the game significantly.
Oh, absolutely. It elevated the whole conflict. It wasn't just about suppressing fringe beliefs anymore. It was becoming a real political power struggle involving some of the most powerful families in France.
And alongside the physical persecution, there was that propaganda war we mentioned.
Yes, really vile stuff. The educated elite might have known better, but they circulated these horrific rumors, Protestants having orgies, eating babies, general debauchery.
And the ordinary people believed it.
The sources say the ignorant masses often did. It was classic dehumanization. If you believe your neighbor is a monster, it's easier to accept or even participate in their persecution.
There was also an attempt to formally bring in the Inquisition.
Yes. After a military victory at Calais boosted the influence of the ultra-Catholic Guise family, Cardinal of Lorraine pushed Henry II to force Parliament to register an edict establishing the Roman Inquisition in France.
How did that go?
He had to hold a special session, a lit de justice, where the king's presence compelled registration. But even then, the sources say it failed of its end. The movement was too widespread by then. The Inquisition couldn't really take root effectively.
And amidst all this chaos and danger, the French Protestant Church actually managed to formally organize and issue a confession of faith.
They did. A remarkable act of coherence in the face of persecution.
And there's that really striking article in it, isn't there? Even after all they'd suffered, they affirmed the state's right, the magistrate's right to punish sins against God's law, including religious ones.
It's fascinating, right? It shows their mindset. They weren't fighting for religious freedom in the modern sense, where everyone believes what they want. They believe they had the truth, and ultimately, they believe the state should uphold that truth.
So the idea of a secular state, or tolerance for all beliefs, that was still a long way off.
A very long way off. For them, it was about replacing a false state-enforced religion with the true one.
Okay, so Henry II dies unexpectedly in 1559, a jousting accident, wasn't it?
That's right, which throws everything into turmoil again. His son, Francis II, is young, sickly. A real power vacuum opens up.
And into that vacuum steps Catherine de' Medici, Henry's widow.
Yes. She's often described as quite timid by nature, but incredibly skilled at dissimulation, as the sources put it, playing people off against each other.
She had to navigate between these powerful factions like the Guises and the Montmorency.
Exactly. And she even very cautiously gave a little encouragement to the Protestants at times. Not out of conviction, probably, but just to keep her options open to counterbalance the Guises. Pure political maneuvering.
This unstable situation leads to the Amboise conspiracy in 1560. What was that about?
It was a plot, mainly by some Protestant nobles, to basically kidnap the young King Francis II and arrest the powerful Guise brothers who they saw as controlling him.
Did it work?
No, it was betrayed. The leaders were caught and executed quite brutally. Some were hanged from the castle walls in Amboise with signs proclaiming them chiefs of the rebels. A very public warning.
Another brutal crackdown. And yet...
paradoxically, the months after Amboise saw what the sources call a sudden harvest for Protestantism. Huge growth. 60 churches in Provence alone. In places like Normandy, Languedoc, the Rhone Valley, Huguenots felt numerous enough, or perhaps desperate enough, to stop hiding.
So repression wasn't working. It might even have been backfiring.
It certainly seemed to strengthen resolve in many areas. Around this time, we get the Edict of Romorantin in 1560. What was the significance of that?
Well, on the surface, it seemed like a concession. It made a distinction between heresy, a religious crime, and sedition, a political crime. Heresy cases were shifted back to the church courts, away from the royal judges like the Parliament.
But was it really a move towards tolerance?
Unlikely. It offered no abatement of rigorous persecution. It was probably more about the crown trying to regain some control, maybe take some heat off the royal courts, which were becoming focal points of resistance. centralizing the process, perhaps, rather than softening it.
Then another twist. The young King Francis II dies suddenly. Just an ear infection.
Which changes everything again. His younger brother, Charles IX, becomes king, but he's a child. So Catherine de' Medici secures the regency, real power.
And Antoine of Navarre, who arguably had the best claim to the regency as the highest-ranking noble, what did he do?
Surprisingly, he conceded it to Catherine. He settled for being lieutenant general of the kingdom. He even publicly reconciled with the Guises, his rivals.
Why would he do that?
Politics. Probably calculated it was better to have influence close to power than risk an open fight for the regency he might lose. It shows how fluid these alliances were. Always calculating.
And this sets the stage for a moment that must have seemed, well, almost unbelievable at the time.
Nah.
The Edict of March, 1561.
It was genuinely surprising. It basically proclaimed an amnesty. Forget past religious offenses. Release everyone imprisoned for heresy.
And even the Parliament of Paris, known for being incredibly anti-Protestant, registered it.
Reluctantly, yes. Only because the king, well, Catherine, acting for the young king, explicitly demanded it. So was this finally a breakthrough? Real tolerance dawning?
It's tempting to think so, but given Catherine's track record and the pressure she was under, it was more likely a strategic pause. A way to calm things down, prevent full-blown civil war, maybe by time, less genuine tolerance, more temporary political expediency.
And following this, Condé, who was implicated in Amboise, was formally declared innocent. There was even a staged reconciliation between him and the Duke of Guise.
A very fragile peace, more papering over cracks than real healing.
This fragile moment leads directly to the colloquy of Quassy in September 1561. What was the hope here?
The hope, pushed by some moderate factions and even the Third Estate, the commoners' representatives, was for some kind of national religious settlement. They actually proposed a national council, led by the king, using only the Bible as a guide, and even suggested giving Protestants official places to worship.
Catherine seemed aware of the deep divisions. She wrote to the Pope saying France was extremely sick.
She knew how serious it was. Yeah. So the colloquy convenes at Poissy. Leading Protestant theologians like Theodore Beza and Peter Martyr were invited to debate Catholic prelates in the presence of the royal family.
Beza made quite an impression, didn't he?
He did. Very eloquent. But the Catholic side immediately narrowed the scope. They insisted the discussion could only be about the nature of the church and the sacraments, especially the Eucharist. No broader theological debate allowed.
Is it doomed from the start, perhaps?
Pretty much. They tried to find a compromise wording on the Eucharist. Peter Martyr suggested Christ's body is in heaven, but received spiritually through faith.
How did that go down?
The Catholic prelates rejected it flat out. The core theological differences were just too deep. The colloquy collapsed without agreement.
What was the main takeaway from its failure?
It proved that reconciliation through theological debate wasn't going to happen. The positions were too entrenched. And its failure actually hardened positions on the Catholic side.
Leading to the formation of the triumvirate.
Exactly. A hardline Catholic alliance formed by the Duke of Guise, Constable Montmorency, who had previously been more moderate, and Marshal Saint-André. They were united in their opposition to Protestantism, and rumors flew about plots for mass extermination.
And on the Protestant side, how are things developing? We see instances of iconoclasm around this time.
Yes, growing boldness, sometimes spilling over into attacks on Catholic churches, smashing statues, breaking stained glass iconoclasm.
But Calvin didn't approve of that, did he?
No, importantly, Calvin strongly condemned individuals taking the law into their own hands. He argued only legitimate authorities, magistrates, should remove idols. He wanted order, not mob rule.
Interesting. It shows a tension within the movement itself about tactics.
Definitely. But the general boldness was increasing. Catholic complaints grew louder about Huguenots meeting openly, singing their psalms loudly in the streets, carrying weapons for self-defense, even being perceived as usurping the entire pavement. They're becoming a very visible, assertive presence.
And the international pressure cooker was heating up, too.
Massively. Philip II of Spain, the arch-Catholic monarch, was putting intense pressure on Catherine. His ambassador basically threatened war if France tolerated Protestantism. He was particularly worried about Antoine of Navarre potentially converting fully to Calvinism.
So France's internal struggles were deeply entangled with the wider European religious and political conflicts.
Absolutely. The stakes were incredibly high, both domestically and internationally.
So looking back over this period we've discussed, from Francis I to the eve of the Wars of Religion, it's just an incredible roller coaster, isn't it?
It really is. You see these moments of seeming tolerance, or at least pragmatism, immediately followed by brutal crackdowns. You see deep religious conviction motivating people on both sides, but also raw political ambition and greed.
And through it all, the resilience of those early reformers and Huguenots is just remarkable. From those first wool carders in Meaux to nobles risking everything.
It's a powerful story about faith, survival, and the human spirit facing down immense power and hostility. And, you know, even though it's centuries ago, it really makes you think about belief, power, how societies handle deep divisions.
It certainly does. That constant tension in the 16th century France, the push for national unity versus the demand for individual conscience, for religious freedom.
Yeah.
It feels very relevant somehow.
Which leads to a final thought maybe for you to ponder. In our own world, still grappling with diverse beliefs, different ways of life, what can we actually learn from this incredibly turbulent French century about the challenges and maybe the necessities of coexistence? How do we navigate difference without resorting to conflict?
A profound question to leave us with. That's all we have time for on this deep dive. Thanks for joining us.
Hey everyone, Glenn Blakeney here. Are you passionate about revival and reformation? Do you want to deepen your understanding of fivefold ministry and how to advance the kingdom in every sphere of life, including the marketplace? Well then join the Kingdom Reformation Leaders Community today. We offer a free subscription to get you started, as well as a monthly plan that provides valuable content and insights. For those seeking even more, our Leaders Plan includes all-inclusive access to a wealth of resources focused on church leadership, apostolic movements, prophetic ministry, and much more. You can engage in live sessions and discussions that explore how to effectively implement these principles in your life and community. With our monthly leaders training featuring esteemed kingdom leaders from around the globe, you'll be equipped to make a transformative impact. Don't miss this chance to grow in your calling and to contribute to the movement of revival and reformation, advancing the kingdom of God to cities and nations. Sign up for the Leaders Plan or any other subscription at kingdomreformation.org today.